Welcome, fellow plebs. My name is Sean, and this is
Tribunus Plebis.
And hello, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast, my friends. Today, we are going to be talking about police unions. And I'm going to make the argument that police unions are bad and that they should not, in fact, exist. I'm not going to talk about reforming these institutions. I'm going to talk about abolishing them and ask a couple of questions along the way. Those questions include, should police unions exist at all? If they do, should they be considered part of a broader labor movement and struggle? On the surface, we have what I think are pretty obvious issues with police unions. They wield massive political influence. They protect bad and even corrupt cops. They are the unrelenting buttress that maintains the blue wall of silence. And they are the tireless lobbyists for tougher laws, harsher sentencing, and are, in fact, the most violent attack dogs of the state. And all of those things and more are extremely important to talk about and focus on, and we will discuss these things for sure. But I want to center this talk here not directly on the shielding of bad and dirty cops, and not even like the more banal sorts of actions that these organizations take part in, like lobbying or collective bargaining, actions which are common to all unions. Rather, I want to actually dig down into what makes police unions different than the typical labor unions on a root level, and I want to base that in class in material conditions. I want to make the argument that police unions are specifically bad without dragging down other unions as well, especially other public sector unions. This is a trap which I feel like a lot of commentators fall into when they discuss this idea. And on this issue, I'm kind of honestly late to the party personally, if I'm being honest. I had generally had the view that everyone should unionize if possible, and that we should support unions unless they're obviously doing horrible things, right? Like a bad union doing bad stuff or shady stuff. It's not all that great, and we should get rid of those. But over the past few years, I started to come around. Slowly at first, then at ever greater speed until I completed a full 180-degree about-face, several years ago, quite a ways back. Though, I guess I don't know precisely when this happened. It happened along the way. What I will argue here is that police unions are not part of the labor movement. In fact, they are the antithesis to that movement. The enemies, even. They are, both historically and presently, the violent, capital and state-sponsored resistance to that movement. Police unions do not seek to make life better for the working class. Indeed, they seek only one thing: to maintain, grow, and empower the police. And since police are the armed agents of the state, like I guess I've said that multiple times now, they are chartered with the express ability to act with a monopoly of force. This presents a very real, very dangerous problem to the public at large, never mind the labor movement itself. This argument isn't that the police are the capitalist bosses themselves, or that they are even that politically motivated. They are, in fact, workers by many definitions of the word, and many of them might even join for the best of reasons. I won't even argue here that police do no good whatsoever. The argument will be that police are little more than puppets and tools of the ruling class, and they are used as weapons to uphold anti-worker policies through intimidation and violence. There is an old argument that the police are not here to protect people. They are here to protect property. I believe this to be an accurate statement, and we will visit this a little bit later. However, if this is the case, and like I said, I believe it is, then the police are here to manage our stratified class society. And if that is true, and again, I believe that it is, then no police union will ever be able to truly work in solidarity with any worker movement or any labor organizing. Let me ask you this. Who is it that shows up when the lower classes express their outrage to quell those very voices? It's always the cops. they're always on that other side, ready to enact violence to please their bosses. They uphold the current conditions and the material conditions under which these same cops exist, demand that they uphold that status quo. They are, in many ways, the foot soldiers of the status quo. This is something I have been thinking about for a while now, and I hope this all makes sense as we go forward. So here goes. Now, police unions themselves, at least how we understand them, are a relatively new thing. And I guess I should say here that unionized police forces aren't new, I suppose. But actually being successful and maintaining an existence, that is new. To find the start of this, at least in the United States, we need to go back to the 19th century. The first Policemen's Benevolent Association, based in New York City, was started in 1892. At the time, it was not a union. Benevolent societies and fraternal orders were more, fraternal. They operated as lodges, and their primary functions were things like raising money for the widows of cops who died on the job, and to provide a place for cops to socialize amongst themselves, and it would also bring complaints and requests to the city government itself. But they did not behave as a labor union with collective bargaining and such, though from the 70s on, this group, the Policemen's Benevolent Association, it would become New York City's largest police union and a very powerful political force in that city and even across the state. Now, in 1919, the AFL, the American Federation of Labor, headed by Samuel Gompers, began to charter police unions under its umbrella. This in and of itself is a bad moment for the labor movement in this country, and no group of labor unions should ever charter police unions, at least in my opinion. So let's all call on the AFL-CIO and anyone else who charters these groups to expel any and all police unions going forward. This first movement of unionization started in Knoxville, Tennessee. It then expanded across the country to almost 40 cities, and it eventually landed in Boston, Massachusetts, where a police union was formed. This led to the famous or infamous Boston police strike of that same year. Now, the thumbnail sketch of this strike that you will probably see is one that says that what followed the strike was that Boston suffered several days and nights of general lawlessness and that 9 people were killed, all before order was restored by Massachusetts governor and future president, Calvin Coolidge, after he called in the troops of the State Guard. What made this reaction so visceral, immediate, harsh, and violent was a certain fear. The fear by the city leaders, the powerful, respectable folks, whether politically powerful or powerful via wealth, you know, whatever difference those two things are, they feared that the police, if they organized, would stop protecting the property and wealth and power of the people in charge, and that they'd actually develop a true consciousness of class and protect the common man. This is real. This is actually what these goobers talked about and feared in their parlors and banking houses, and this is a thread which we will pick up probably several times as we move along here. History, of course, has proved them wrong about who the cops would protect in the end, but we will get there in a couple of minutes. Now, truth be told, there was some general mayhem during the Boston police strike. Boys throwing rocks at streetcars, tipping vendors' pushcarts over, even some straight-up smash-and-grab robberies of storefronts. But this sort of thing was, according to the New York Times, relegated to a few specific locations, and overall, the city went on as if nothing had changed. Now, 9 people were actually killed. This is true. You might even read that, quote, "A man died at a riot in Scole Square," end quote. Notice the passive tense there. A man died. He just happened to die at Scole Square. And no. He was actually murdered. And what they really mention is that he was murdered by the State Guard. Another man was murdered by the State Guard for refusing to walk away from a dice game. In fact, 8 of the 9 murders committed during the strike were all by the State Guard, not out of control civilians basking in the freedom of having no cops around. The last murder, that of a striking policeman named Remus, he was shot by a business owner after he had single-handedly disarmed and whooped on two strike-breaking state guardsmen. Now, normally I wouldn't talk so nice about a cop like that, but I guess that just sums it all up, right? Fighting against strike breakers and some petite bourgeois loser shoots you, the same guy that you were trying to protect his property of yesterday. The strike would soon be broken. All the cops involved were fired, and they were replaced by 1,500 new cops. And that there is the 10-cent story, or I guess in this case, the free story, of the 1919 Boston police strike. Now, I laid that all out because this story contains a lot of little tidbits that we will talk about going forward. Class relations, labor movement strikes, and so on. The more modern influx of police unions began in the 1960s with the legalization of public sector unions across many states. Although, the oldest continuing police union was started in 1942, and it actually continues to this very day in Portland, Oregon. By the early 1970s, the police forces of every large U.S. city had been successfully unionized. And from the very first moments of this then-new surge in unionization of departments, the police turned their backs on the labor movement, even as they took advantage of many of its aspects. As soon as they were unionized, they abandoned both the movement and the working class, which that movement is meant to help. Okay, so that was a bit of the history, and now we are here, the present day. Police unions are present in almost every state all across the nation. The latest numbers I could find state that there are a little over 800,000 duty-sworn officers of the law in the United States, and about 80% of those officers belong to a union. That's at least 640,000 organized cops across the country. If I did my math right, that is not a guarantee. And we might wonder, like, why aren't they all organized? Well, that's mostly because a handful of states either make public sector unions illegal or otherwise block police from unionizing. So before we get our hands dirty here, let's get some of the more common arguments against police unions out of the way here first. The fact that police unions protect dirty cops, even killer cops, and create cultures of silence, violence, and unaccountability. These are the most frequently cited bad aspects of these unions, and they are very bad and worth discussing. I'm not going to spend a ton of time on these specific things because I believe it to be so glaringly obvious that to spend 30 minutes over-explaining it would insult everyone's intelligence, and besides that, there are just tons and tons of articles and videos which will break this part down for anyone who is interested. But I do think it's fair to spend 2 or 3 minutes or so here, maybe a little more, I'm not sure, but just running through a few events just as quick as I can to help support these arguments before we move on. So we all remember George Floyd, right? The man who was murdered by Officer Derek Chauvin. The same Chauvin had 19 complaints levied against him over the years, none of which had resulted in any real punishment at all. And this is incredibly common. Amongst all of Minneapolis cops, the city where this incident happened, this murder happened, sorry about that, there were 2,600 complaints over a decade, and only 12 resulted in any punishment at all. This is entirely normal for any police agency. Bootlickers might argue that, hey, you know, cops get complaints all the time because they're cops just doing their job and it makes people angry. But we know this isn't entirely true, don't we? Sure, some amount of complaints might be exaggerated and even a few might be outright fake, but the majority are indeed legitimate. And even in the rare instances that an officer faces real punishment, even when they are found so guilty and even so egregiously guilty that they actually get fired, they just get rehired either by the same department or by one in a neighboring city or town. For example, in 2014, 26 Philadelphia police officers were fired for flagrant offenses, according to Forbes. They were fired for things like being drunk at work, yes, drunkenly driving around with a gun and broad discretion to use it. the ability to deprive people of their freedom, plus the power trip that just comes with that badge. They had all of that while drunk. Always a good combo. All of that stuff plus booze is so awesome. They were also fired for excessive use of force as well, and theft. Of the 26 who were fired, 19 were simply rehired after arbitration. Arbitration which the union supported them through. And just to be clear here, these are cops who were so clearly bad that even the other cops were like, we need to fire these cops. And then the union got them rehired by the same people who just fired them. This is bizarre. But when you realize that the average police union contract contains at least 4 progressive layers of protections, as well as extended time periods before anyone even approaches an actual judgment, we can see where this sort of parochial bargaining leads us. And hello there, everybody. As most of you probably know, this podcast takes a lot of time and effort to put together and, you know, to get out there for you good folks to listen to. And you, our listeners, can help us by liking and subscribing on YouTube. So please take a second to click those little buttons. It helps a ton. And if you are feeling just a little bit more generous and you enjoy what we do here at Tribunus Plebis Media, you can help us earn just a little bit of money for the large amount of labor that we put into this thing by signing up on our Buy Me a Coffee page, where you can make a one-time donation or sign up for a recurring monthly subscription. We do all of this for free, and we will never run ads in our works. But any contributions really do help keep the show going and improving. The page address is buymeacoffee.com/tribunusplebis. And of course, all links will be in the show notes and descriptions wherever you are listening or watching. Thank you. And now, back to the episode. To more directly tie this sort of thing to unions, we can talk about the Buffalo cop who shoved a 75-year-old man to the ground during a peaceful protest, which resulted in serious injuries. This was in a BLM George Floyd protest. The entire event was captured in 4K HD from multiple angles. Two officers were suspended for nearly killing this man. Not fired, suspended. As a result of these soft-handed suspensions, the other 57 members of the special unit resigned from that unit. They didn't quit their jobs, they just refused to be assigned to this specific unit. Real bravery, am I right? And the union came out and very loudly backed the two officers and those who resigned from that unit. The Buffalo Police Union head, a man named John Evans, even said that Gugino, the 75-year-old, quote, he did slip in my estimation. He fell backwards, end quote. A statement which defies the eyes of the entire world who were able to view this video the same day that it happened. This would have been a great example of unions protecting bad cops right there. Obvious guilt. The union not only supports the cop, but actually just bold-faced lies about it. And it doubles down. But Evans even went one step further and actually rolled out the old Nazis in Nuremberg defense. They were merely following orders defense. The use of the following orders defense would be shocking coming from anyone but a cop. Now this logic can be applied to 1,000 cases, both famous and unknown, and the backbone of this system is the police union. Here's another sickening example of police unions gone wrong. After a police officer murdered 12-year-old Tamir Rice, shooting him dead before his car had even stopped rolling, this is what the police union released as a statement from union president Stephen Loomis. I should add here that this was released as a statement after a judgment had been levied against the city, and this was union president Stephen Loomis. Quote, we can only hope that the Rice family and their attorneys will use a portion of this settlement to help educate the youth of Cleveland in the dangers associated with the mishandling of both real and facsimile firearms. End quote. The cop in this case had been previously fired by a neighboring town after being declared mentally unstable and unfit for duty. He had lied to get the job in Cleveland where he killed Tamir, a lie which was enabled by police unions blocking access to public records, and he had fired his gun within 2 seconds of confronting the 12-year-old for playing in a park with a toy gun. All of that, and the press release basically told Rice's parents, family, and friends, and his entire community, that it was Tamir's fault. And not just that their son deserved to be gunned down by a disturbed cop who was unfit for duty, but that the family itself now bore responsibility to protect other children from these same murderous police forces. Nothing in the statement about a cop unfit for duty, a mentally unstable cop, a cop so terrified that he took the life of a 12-year-old as soon as he was within his sights. Not a single word about how the police need to do better and avoid murdering 12-year-old children. Just blame on the victim and blame on the victim's family. The union here understood its job and its purpose. It is there to protect the police from the public. Most people might assume that a police union would have some want or need to stop bad cops, to protect the public from bad cops. Unfortunately, this is not what unions do. They don't protect you or I, they only protect the police. And this is, of course, absolutely disgusting, but also absolutely par for the course. These organizations perform some functions like a real union. They collectively bargain for wages, as an example, but this is only to hide their true function, that of self-serving political actors and purveyors of finely aged protection rackets. They bully the proletariat for their bougie handlers, all the while influencing civic leaders for longer leashes and more freedom to bite. All of this is handled by the union. They create systems with multiple 3, 4, 5, 6, even more layers of protection for bad cops. They even, when the bad cops get fired, they make sure that they get hired somewhere else. How the police collectively bargain presents another issue as well, one rooted in democratic ideals. The union bargains for how they are regulated, controlled, and so on. They decide how to handle shootings, even good shootings. They decide how to handle corruption, bad shootings, and every other infraction on the job. They decide who gets to investigate their failings even, and it's usually just other cops. What this does is it prevents the public, the voters, the societies which these people are supposed to serve and protect, from having any control over the people with the guns and the authority to kill them. This imposes on the society a great risk of violence, terror, abuse, and even death. Because if the only people with a real true interest in how police behave have no power over those same police, then the police can act with near impunity to harm, harass, abuse, and even kill them. To add some weight to those accusations, here are some numbers from a University of Chicago paper titled Collective Bargaining Rights and Police Misconduct, Evidence from Florida. This paper showed a 40% increase in violent misconduct amongst Florida sheriff's officers after the state Supreme Court allowed these cops to unionize. 40% increase in violence from the sheriff's deputies after they were allowed to be in a union and protected. Unreal. A Bureau of Justice statistics report from 2006 showed that unionized police received 9.9 use of force complaints per 100 officers. Non-union police averaged 7.3 complaints per 100 officers. That's 30% more for unionized police. In union agencies, the rate at which the police found these complaints to have merit was at a rate of just about 7%. Non-union police forces doubled the amount of complaints having merit at 15%, actually a little bit more than doubling it. So unionized cops are significantly more likely to commit violent acts and much less likely to be held accountable. Awesome. Wonderful news, guys. Everything is perfect. Police unions also wield massive political influence, especially in big cities. And every time the police unions assert their immense power, they use it to push conservative policies. This is just who they are. It's endemic to policing. And if you hear that and are like, damn, don't they usually support the Democrats? Yeah, they usually do, or they often do. But they support the most conservative of the Democrats. They endorse the furthest right of the already conservative Democratic Party. When Mayor de Blasio in New York suspended two cops for obvious brutality, which was videotaped, they literally turned their backs on him and made him come to heel and beg for forgiveness. Now, one of the more stunning things I found here regarding how the police protect themselves with the blue wall of silence and the entirety of their culture, really, was contained in the decision of a case called LaPorta versus the City of Chicago. I stumbled on this case somewhere in my digging around for the episode, and I really wish I could figure out how I got there so I could give a little bit of credit. But I was reading this legal decision, and I hit a point that made me stop just because of how out loud everything was in it. The specifics of this case aren't super important, but I'll, you know, hit them real quick. An off-duty cop went drinking with a buddy, and after drinking for a while, they both went back to the cop's house, both of them extremely drunk. The friend was somehow shot in the head with the officer's service weapon and rendered paralyzed. The friend says that the drunk cop shot him. The cop says that the drunk friend tried to kill himself. Now, whichever is telling the truth, the friend sued the city because he felt like the police department was covering for their brother in blue. There are a lot of pieces of evidence here supporting this, but again, it's not too terribly important. The big thing here is that he is suing the city and arguing that the city has allowed, by the acceptance of a de facto, if unwritten rule, a certain culture. A corrupt culture which includes the blue wall of silence and the covering up of cops' crimes by other cops. Now, because of all of this, the questionable shooting, the possible cover-up, the trial, and so on, the Federal Department of Justice got involved. The DOJ investigated and they filed a report. The report concluded in part that, quote, the city, police officers, and leadership within CPD, the Chicago Police Department, and its police officer union acknowledged that a code of silence among Chicago police officers exists, extending to lying and affirmative efforts to conceal evidence, end quote. The department, its officers, and the union all acknowledged the corruption. It was also noted in the same report that the IPRA, the Independent Police Review Authority of the city, quote, treats such efforts to hide evidence as ancillary and unexceptional misconduct, and often does not investigate it, causing officers to believe there is not much to lose if they lie to cover up misconduct. End quote. So the people who are supposed to investigate the police see so much hiding of evidence that they don't even find it worth talking about, which frees the cops to just simply lie to them even more. What kind of crap is this? Seriously, man. Disgusting behavior all around. So the union both creates and obviously knows about this culture. They literally tell you that they know about the culture of silence, this culture of corruption, and the culture of unaccountability. But it doesn't care. And the very people who are supposed to investigate the police, the IPRA, a non-police review board, simply accept that culture of corruption, cover-ups, and the Omerta Code of Silence as, and this is again from the DOJ report, quote, an immutable fact rather than something to root out, end quote. And I'm still stunned by it, that it just, this was all just laid out there this clearly and with eyes so wide open into a public document. I mean, we all know this happens, but to just see the city, the IPRA, the cops themselves, the union, the DOJ, and everyone else to just be so damn blasé about it, it's really quite shocking in a way. It's also, honestly, a little heartbreaking. I mean, you know that they're corrupt, and they're just like, yeah, we're corrupt. Like, right into a microphone, everybody's like, yeah, yeah, we know. It's all right. Unreal. And this attitude, it also makes every cop, union, civil review board, city government, or anyone else connected obvious liars, forever denying that these things exist, pretending that they don't exist, and supporting them. They know about it. They do nothing to stop it. And the union is one of the most responsible entities for this absolutely despicable state of affairs. Every single time that the safety of the public collides with cops getting to do whatever they want to do, the public loses. The interests of police always trump our own safety. And every time the police lose a case like this, or the Tamir Rice case, or the Floyd case, the police force taxpayers to pay for their corruption, violence, negligence, terrorism, and hubris to the tune of tens of millions of dollars a year. They kill people in cold blood, rape, rob, deal drugs, frame people, extort, cover up crimes, and they keep their jobs, or on the rare occasion that they get fired, they just get rehired the next town over. And even if they leave the police forever, very few ever see the inside of a cell. And when they're found guilty, once again, the union protects them. Cops don't pay, the police department doesn't pay, taxpayers pay the citizens for the police misconduct. This is how the racket works. And if you want to see just how badly this sort of culture, protected by unions, of course, can get, go watch the movie Serpico, or read the book, or just read the Wikipedia article. It's all right out there. Okay, so I think we understand how unions protect the corrupt and create an unaccountable, violent, state-controlled paramilitary oppression force. And I'm sorry if even that brief rundown was a bit too much. I went on a little bit longer than I expected to there, but let's move into what I think is the more interesting territory here and talk about class, labor, and so on, and see why these unions shouldn't exist from that angle as well. So the first thing I want to say is that we should never consider the police to be workers. Sure, they get paid for what they do, but they are not workers, in this, at least in the sense of the working class or the proletariat. To my mind, the police are the epitome of the idea of the lumpen, the unorganizable along class lines. Their very existence is diametrically opposed to the formation and consciousness of the working class. Or to be more plain about it, the police exist with the express purpose of resisting the organization of the working class. They oppose us. This has been true from the very beginning. From the very origin of policing, they have been against the lower classes, the poor. This is 100%, and it is explicit. Some might argue that the police were and are often hired from the poor, and this is largely true as well. These people were lured into being used as the armed wing of capital against the class which they come from. They sold their class, their families, and their homies for power and coin. The origin of policing and specific police forces in the South is inextricably tied to slavery and slave catchers, the slave patrols. Those proto-cops, who were used to regulate, capture, beat, and control the slaves of this country, and they were in turn formed into state-sponsored security, quote-unquote, security forces. These new police forces had their charters change after the freeing of the slaves. Rather than hunting escaped slaves, they regulated the lives of former slaves, who the racist whites kind of considered escaped anyways, even if by other means. They were formed to control the populace of newly freed black people, and even to regulate poor whites as well. In the North, there were a few slight differences due to the relative lack of slaves. In this case, the newly forming police forces were instead directed to their own local, quote-unquote, dangerous classes, normally the poorest members of the city or region, and this in turn was often people of color, immigrants, and religious minorities, amongst others, but draggled workers all, who the capitalist feared would rebel, and any ethnic or racial groups which the powers that be happened to be in fear of at that time in that location. They did this through curiously drafted laws like the Black Codes, curiously drafted in quotes there, and by simply selectively enforcing broader laws which would technically affect anyone, but were rarely used on anyone but the most oppressed. The biggest danger to the bourgeoisie and the cops who they controlled was the prospect that these supposedly dangerous people working together to improve their lot in life, and they used the police to blunt this danger with their own unfettered violence. In 1876, a report was published by the General Superintendent of Police of Chicago, and in it was written this, quote, "There is in every large city a dangerous class of idle, vicious persons eager to band themselves together for purposes subversive to the public peace and good government," end quote. The focus of the police even back in 1876 was not on bosses. It was not on bosses abusing humans, or bosses stealing from workers, or bosses literally destroying lives. It wasn't on the wealthy robbing the poor, or even the wealthy actually taking actual lives. Instead, the police were organized, hired, and maintained as means to control the poor people and to regulate them. They were there expressly to harshly and violently oppress people trying to better their lives. We see this primarily with strike breaking, the intimidation, beating, and murdering of people who dare to stand up to their bosses. The police were dead-eye focused on preventing poor people from being comfortable enough to talk to each other, to organize each other, and to fight for a better life and a better world. For a wonderful example here, we can point our fingers to the Coal and Iron Police of Pennsylvania. They were formed in 1865 and would last in some form or another until 1935. They were created ostensibly to protect the private property of mine and railroad owners, but truthfully, they were employed almost exclusively as union busters and strike breakers. The Coal and Mine Police were paid for and maintained by the companies and served the company's needs exclusively. The body of this police force was made up of thugs, murderers, and adventure-seeking gunmen, and they, just like our current police, served their own material needs by causing much of the violence of the era to reinforce the supposed need of their employment. They went out, this is, what do we call them today? Agents provocateur? Is that the right word? That's what they were doing. They would go out, they would cause violence, and they'd be like, oh, look, violence, to gain more power, right? Just like cops today. Now, it was due to the Coal and Iron Police's ultra-violent actions during the anthracite coal strike in 1902 that the force began to lose its hold and lost the trust of the public, most of the public anyway. In 1905, the Coal and Iron Police would begin to get pushed into the background by the formation of the Pennsylvania State Police, a force which would largely mirror the work of the Coal and Iron Police, only this time under direct state control. With the stroke of a pen, the governor of Pennsylvania turned the awful Coal and Iron Police into the State Police. Just a slight change, went from private to state controlled, and it wasn't a total one-for-one swap, but that's basically what it was. After the state police were formed in Pennsylvania, the Coal and Iron Police rapidly lost power. Even today, and this is, I guess it's kind of a little bit off topic, but wage theft is far and away surpasses like literally every other form of theft in this entire country all added together. And not a single cop cares, right? They just don't care. It's not their problem. No law enforcement agency really does. And even if they did, they'd get laughed at. But if an employee doesn't report or maybe even doesn't notice an extra 10% in their paycheck, the police will bounce that poor soul's skull off the wall, tackle them, crank their arms behind their backs, deprive them of their freedom, and lock them in a cage over $25 if they are asked to by the bosses. The homeless person arrested for stealing deodorant or for yelling at cars or jaywalking or whatever, sleeping in the wrong spot, he'll get treated less well than the corporate Wall Street goon who made that person homeless in the first place. It's a bizarre, goddamn thing, but this is what cops do. All cops, police, prison guards, ICE, all of them, they uphold a system meant to destroy so many for the benefit of so few. Police are, by the very nature of what they do, part of the managerial, capital bourgeois side of things. They are, again, by their very existence, wholly removed from class consciousness and fully subsumed in an idea of internal, job-based solidarity that is incongruous with both recognizing and being in solidarity with the interest of the working class, with anybody not being a cop. Being a cop becomes everything. They are police before everything else. This extreme sort of internal solidarity that applies only to those within your profession, and at the same time, you know, like lowers literally everybody else on the outside to a position of inferiority and assumed submission, makes it fundamentally different from the sort of solidarity that the working class relies on to help lift each other up. Solidarity across class should always be superior to the same within a job. This is how we organize and fight, by fighting with and for each other. Yes, we do in fact fight for ourselves during negotiations for contracts and within our profession, but ultimately, we should show solidarity with others as well. Workers want to protect workers. Cops want to protect cops and property. And that's it. That's where they stop. And I was just sort of trying to think about like a comparison as I was babbling there about solidarity. And it struck me to wonder about a question, or I guess two or maybe three questions here. Question one is, like, what happens when you empower teachers like this? And then the next question is, what happens when you empower cops? I think that teachers would improve their schools. Cops would lock more people up. Teachers would purchase pencils. Cops would buy bigger guns. Teachers would invest both money and energy into trying to raise children out of poverty cycles. Cops would lock up their parents over some nonsense. Teachers would want to build the community, I believe. Cops would want to control the dangerous poor and tear it all down. We literally see this all across the country. We see Border Patrol agents, another group that falls under the ACAB umbrella that I think I forgot about in the beginning of this episode, as they seek broader leeway to arrest more people. Border Patrol has even lobbied to expand its sphere of influence further away from the border. And then we have ICE, perhaps the worst of the worst in this group of awful humans, seeks much the same thing. More power, more incarceration, more freedom to abuse the most vulnerable, less oversight. Hell, the Border Patrol and ICE even lobby against changes to how people become citizens here, all just to maintain their own self-interest, to rule over their little fiefdoms, and to arrest and hurt and harm more people. And speaking of incarceration, let's talk about the prison guards in California, one of the more powerful unions in the entire country, even with only just about 30,000 members. And the critiques that I'm about to levy here against the prison guards in California, this extends to prison guard unions all across the country. It's not just California. This is just one that I know a little bit about. This union, they are, quite frankly, rather disgusting. They use their massive resources to lobby for more prisons, as well as stricter laws, harsher sentencing guidelines, more cash bail, more difficult paths to parole, and dozens of other awful, terrible ideas. They also fight, quite often successfully, against things like removing cash bail, less punitive sentencing, and earlier and easier paths to parole. They even have successfully fought to prevent new systems of treatment and therapy for prisoners, as well as against statewide attempts at early intervention before the at-risk commit prison-worthy crimes. Prison-worthy to them, anyway. They actually have fought against trying to prevent crimes, because then they'd have fewer prisoners to treat like cattle and ring for profit for corporations. Hello, 13th Amendment, we see you. These are truly a repugnant set of goals to have, and which only makes sense when you start to view yourself as a profession rather than as a human being or part of something greater. And listen, maybe, you know, perhaps I'm being a bit too harsh here. Let's pretend that there are good cops for a moment. And maybe a lot of them start out that way, right? They just want to help serve their community. So now they're a cop, and the people of their city or state or nation decide that for whatever reason, they want to protest their conditions. They go downtown and march around with signs and chant their chants, right? They march around, they block a major intersection along the way, maybe. Maybe they take over a small park and have a sit-in. Maybe they march around town hall. Now the cops are called and asked to intervene. Which side will those cops be on? They're going to be on their own side, they're cops. They're above those struggling, right? We've already established that. And as part of being on their own side, they gladly will serve capital because they're controlled by them. So they put on their armor, they pick up their clubs, and they go out there and they just follow orders and start beating people, arresting people, and gassing people. The material interest of the protesters is to improve their lives. The material interest of the police is to support the status quo. They are there to maintain and expand the horrific degradation of the working class, not to break it down. Every single damn time that the police are sent to any sort of demonstration, strike, mass movement, protest, or whatever else, they serve one particular class's interest, and it is not ours. Never. Not once. This history goes back to the thuggish strikebreakers of the turn of the 20th century industrialized cities, the ultra-violent sheriffs and posses of the rural mining towns, and the private detectives like the Pinkertons and the Baldwin Felts Agency, as well as the slave patrols, all of which had a primary function of holding down the working class and the poor by any means necessary. These means included murder, too many to mention, to be honest, kidnapping. Big Bill Haywood was famously kidnapped along with a few others and transported to another state to be tried for a crime that he didn't commit. They committed mass beatings like during the Lawrence Mill strikes or the Memorial Day massacre in Chicago. How then, since this is the case, can police unions ever actually help the proletariat if helping the proletariat harms the very concept of policing? It's like the scorpion and the frog, right? At the end of the day, the cops are just scorpions. They have a nature which they always fall back on. In this case, it isn't necessarily that they sting per se, though they definitely do sting. It's more that these police unions, like, they serve just one thing. They serve their members, own extremely narrow self-interest. Well, I guess they serve something else, too. They serve capital as well. Now, if I were to extend some sort of best possible view to police unions remaining a thing, you know, to keep existing, I tend to think of something like all that they could do in this case is collectively bargain for wages and benefits that any normal job would have, and that's it. They can't help design how they are controlled, regulated, or held accountable. They can't influence politics or investigate themselves. All they can do is ask for wages and better healthcare. And maybe if that were the case, maybe I'd let them survive. Maybe. Maybe. But probably not. There are just too many issues with police as an entity to give them even that much power. And, I guess I'll maybe try to put it a slightly different way as I try to wrap this up. Imagine that there is a picket line of striking workers outside of a business. Let's say a grocery store in, this example. The workers are on strike and picketing the store. In that line, you might find truck drivers walking the picket line in solidarity. You might also find auto workers or pilots or teachers holding signs and chanting with the deli counter ladies, or see a, machinist bringing water to the refreshment table. You'll see solidarity all around you. So picture all of that in your head. The striking workers themselves, those who show up and walk the line with them in solidarity, the refreshment tables being restocked by other union workers. Let that mental image form. Now, put 10 cops into this mental picture and tell me where they are in the scene. I guarantee that they aren't marching with the workers or dropping off pizza for lunch. They're probably white-knuckling their clubs, ready to defend the profits of the billionaire store owners. And if not that, then they are absolutely eyeballing everybody there, hoping they can find an excuse to break the picket up and maybe even break some bones. Am I right or wrong? I bet I was right. I bet that's how you pictured it. Now, police unions will sometimes mask their anti-worker biases by actually supporting rules or laws or even just sort of norms about collective bargaining. And I guess that might be a little confusing, so I guess to maybe be a little more clear, they will actually support the concept of collective bargaining. And they'll look like allies to worker-based unions or the general public. But again, this sort of stance is entirely selfish and based only around their own narrow self-interest. To be true allies with the working class, they would have to either bargain to reduce their own, like coercive and violent influence and free themselves from their bougie puppeteers, or they would need to abolish themselves so that the working class can be as free as possible. The goal of worker unionization is certainly to improve local work conditions, but it also expands to work conditions for entire industries and even related industries. And at its best, it works to improve the material conditions of the entire working class. Police unions work only for police. There is no other step. There is no other, thought to their entire process. Police unions are the exact opposite of global or even class-oriented in any way. They are so parochial and for themselves that their existence actually harms society at large. They might throw around talking points about being supportive of collective bargaining and say they believe in the right to strike, but when push comes to shove, the police will abandon these ideas and protect Walmart's profits from striking workers, and they will do it with as much violence as they damn well please. Police identify with the bosses. They serve the bosses. And they act as the military arm of the bosses. And they do it at each and every opportunity while also turning their back on the people that they really should identify with more, but can't. Because they're cops. And that is more important than being a decent human being. They serve capital because they don't care about workers or the working class or the poor. They only care about two things. One is being a cop. The other is serving the rich. And the reality is that you can't be the first one of those things, the cop, without being the second, serving the rich. And all of that, but especially those last few things, are why the answers to the questions that I left open at the beginning of this episode, the questions that you all probably forgot about by now, whether police unions should exist and whether they should be considered part of the labor movement if they do remain, both answers are emphatic no's. And that, my friends, is the end of the episode. I hope you liked it. Agree, disagree, let me know in the comments. Like, subscribe, wherever you are. Links to everything are in the description. Thank you very much. Love you all.